Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. On today's episode, I welcome science researcher and author Annie Murphy-Paul, and we speak about the extended mind, the power of thinking beyond the brain, her newest book and way of life.
And what was so interesting to me over and over and over again when I was researching that book was that scientists were discovering things that other cultures and other times had known through generations. And so sometimes we need science to put its stamp on stuff that, you know, humanity has kind of already figured out.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I'm your host, Luis Mojica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music. And then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences, as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. Today's conversation is one of those gooey ones that I just love, because it's when someone who has a background in science and certain terminologies and languages comes on the show and validates and gives a container for understanding what I've always known in my body to be true. This woman's work is fantastic. Client and friend sent me her book, or no, actually an interview with her about her book, The Extended Mind. And then I picked up her book, listened to a ton of interviews, and I was just in love with her research and her understanding of the mind not having anything to do with the brain. And of course, that interests me as a somatic therapist, because my work is all about seeing how the entire body relates to thought and to behavior and to food and to environment and to beings, using the whole body head to toe, and even the parts of the body that can reach out through the nervous systems, almost like a transmitter, right? So there is this extended experience when we become more embodied and we're able to feel out into our spaces. And I think what interested me the most was for quite a while, I had always felt like the subconscious was the body. And I teach from that place and I practice from that place and I live from that understanding. And I know that to be true from my own experiences as a musician, where my hands will play something on the piano that I have no idea what I'm playing. I have to record it. And then my conscious self has to actually learn those notes again and be able to play it until it becomes something in my muscle memory. Then I can perform it or record it or compose around it. But from those compositions that just kind of are made from my body, there's stories that come with them. And those stories are often cryptic mythologies of my own traumatic or beautiful experiences. And it's after I write them and record them and listen to them, I actually understand what it is I'm talking about. But none of this is conscious. I don't sit down with a map about what chord I'm going to use or what kind of arrangement this is going to be or what the idea of the song is. It just comes out from my hands and my stomach and my legs and my feet. It comes out of my body. And so for many years as a musician, using music in this more therapeutic way, I've been able to access my shadow and my unconscious and my subconscious through, you know, playing, moving my hands and fingers on the keyboard. Then fast forward to training in somatic psychologies and somatic experiencing, really learning to understand that so much of our behavior and our desires and the things we say are reflexive, and they come from a subconscious, unconscious place within the body of memory, of threat, of expectation, of association. So many things this body does, and I have very little to do with it. From the growth of hair to the digestion of food to flicking my hand out when I'm speaking publicly to an audience. My body is doing what it knows how to do to exist and to live and to be here. And one thing that has happened through colonization and different cultural influences is we've moved from a movement from our bodies into a worshiping of our minds. And what comes with that worshiping of the mind, for some reason, is this oppression of the body, this self-colonization, where the psyche starts telling the body that it can't be its natural self. Whether that's who it loves, whether that's what it likes to wear, how it wants to move, or when it wants to cry, or when it wants to say no or yes. The psyche says, you're not allowed to do that. I'm going to control you. And this cultural shift from letting the body move and relating to everything around us, shifting into a place that's much more isolated that says, my mind is supreme. Everything else must be dominated or controlled. And we can see that in our society. We can see that the way a town or a city is built. It's not necessarily built around the land and how the land moves. It's built through the land and on top of the land without much regard to the natural climate or beings that have already lived there. We see it in our bodies. We see the products of the store that are marketed to make our bodies look like they don't fit into the standard, but this product will bring us into the standard. We see it in our education, which Annie and I speak about in this interview, how we are rewarded and valued for being able to oppress the body so it can fit in. And I say, fit into what? The standard. And how did it become standard? That's the question we want to sit with. Who decides it's a standard, right? Do I want to keep upholding the standard? Or do I want to be part of this peaceful movement of relating to my entire body as equally as I relate to my thoughts and people and beings outside of my body? Annie's work really gives context and language to a demographic of people that might not understand it otherwise, might see this work as primitive, might see it as outdated. And I really respect her for having the language and the dedication to bring this understanding to much larger audiences. So I hope you enjoy this interview. I loved it, and I'm definitely going to have her back in the future. I want to welcome Annie Murphy-Paul to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, you know, I've listened to a few of your interviews. I started reading your book, and I'm just, it's kind of, it's speaking to everything that I do, but I have no language for. You know, it's kind of like what I'm learning with the work I do. So I'm so excited for you to bring your language to us here. And I first wanted just to ask you to introduce yourself to my audience. You know, what's your work? Who are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm so glad you said what you just said, because I've heard that from a lot of readers, that this book made them feel seen in some way, because it kind of validated what they'd already found their way to, the art solutions and techniques that they'd already started applying in their own lives. But the book provides language and maybe also some scientific backup for the real reasons why those techniques and approaches work. So I'm a science writer. I write about learning and cognition, and I found my way to writing about the extended mind, which is what this most recent book is about, through some work I was doing on the science of learning. I have two kids who are now in middle school and high school, but when they first started school, I just got really interested in learning and how learning happens, how their teachers were teaching them, you know, all this stuff. And as a science writer, I realized at the same time that there was lots of really exciting research going on in terms of figuring out how people learn. And one of the most exciting areas of learning research to me was the stuff that was not quite traditional learning research. In other words, it wasn't looking at how the brain processes information. And instead, it was about how the brain reaches outside of itself to pull in all these other resources to help it do its thinking. And that to me was super interesting and fresh and not something I'd really thought about very much before. But once I started digging into these areas of research about how we use the body and how we use physical space and how we use our relationships with other people to do our thinking, that just seemed like that was the work, that was the book I needed to write. You know, and the extended mind, the theory of the extended mind, is actually a concept borrowed from philosophy. So it's not my idea, but when I came across it, I realized that it was the idea that could pull together all these strands that I'd been noticing in the research.
Okay, so I'm jotting down notes as you're speaking, because there's three things you said that were so important to me. Using body, using spaces, using other people. Mm-hmm. As a somatic therapist, I hear these terms like neuroception and co-regulation and environmental attunement. And before we even get there, I'm also wondering, we're saying mind. Now, are we also saying nervous system? Like, tell me the relationship between mind and nervous system.
Yeah. Well, or even mind and brain, right? What's the difference? And that was really the insight that I gained from the extended mind. These two philosophers, Andy Clark and David Chalmers, they published a paper in 1998 called The Extended Mind and introducing this idea. And the first line of the article says, "Where does the mind stop and the rest of the world begin?" You know, and it's a provocative question, because I think we would naturally assume that the mind ends at the skull. The mind is the brain. And what they were saying is, no, the mind is much bigger than the brain. The mind encompasses the rest of the body, you know, which includes the nervous system. And so we're very much thinking with the entire nervous system and not just with the brain. But the mind also extends out into space, physical space, and it extends into our relationships with other people. So it's a much more expansive and capacious kind of vision of what the mind is. It doesn't limit the mind to the brain.
That's so gorgeous. It doesn't limit it to time and space, essentially, does it?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Not in the way that we usually think about it, because One of those philosophers I mentioned, Andy Clark, he likes to talk about how our culture is very brain bound, meaning we're very attached to this idea that everything happens up here. Mm-hmm. And when you're brain bound, you're really missing a lot of what is going on in terms of how we actually are thinking with our bodies all the time. We are deeply influenced by our setting and our environment all the time. We are thinking with other people and in concert with other people. And so if we stay attached to this idea that it's all happening inside the individual brain, we're just like, there's a lot we're not seeing.
It's interesting because it brings in that understanding of kind of like mind or brain supremacy, let's say, versus mm-hmm. like the body being just as important. And what we would have once labeled as primitive is actually very sophisticated, the body, right?
Totally, totally. Yes. And one example of that I love is that, people are always worrying that artificial intelligence is going to become smarter than us any day now, you know, and they're going on the fact that computer scientists have been really successful in getting computers to say, play chess and like, beat even like Garry Kasparov, like world champions at chess. So they can do that. And so we look at computers and we're like, oh my gosh, they're so smart. They're smarter than humans. But it turns out that all these things that humans do so easily and effortlessly, even a child, you know, navigating their environment or speaking fluidly with other people or having those internal sensations within the body that help guide us, those things are really, really hard to program into a computer. And so, the wellsprings of our human intelligence are really located in the body and in the fact that we're embedded in environments and the fact that we are deeply social, you know, all those things are really the fonts of our intelligence, and we're cutting ourselves off from them if we think of ourselves as kind of glorified computers.
Mm. I'm so glad you said that, because earlier you said the term capacious, and I was mm-hmm. thinking of capacity around learning. And when I'm thinking of these three things you said, body, environment or spaces, and other people, the word relation comes up for me, right? Mm-hmm. Like my mm-hmm. body's ability to relate to the space and relate mm-hmm. to the people actually builds my capacity for learning. Explain to me what that means.
Yeah, well, I think this whole idea pushes back against the idea that of separation and distance and detachment, which is those are ideas and concepts that are promoted by our culture. But again, I think they're really mistaken. They're inaccurate in describing the world as it actually is. And in practice, they cut off a lot of our potential sources of intelligence, because actually although we have this idea that mind and body are separate, actually they're incredibly related and intertwined. And we're really, as I've been saying, really affected by the spaces we're in. And we're really always kind of attuning ourselves to other people and in relation to other people. So it's really a philosophical, it's not a minor tweak, you know, it's like really kind of turning Western culture and a lot of its most cherished assumptions kind of on its head. And I think it's about time that happens, because the individualistic, separate kind of model of the self and of the mind is so limiting. And I think we're bumping up against those limits more and more.
I love hearing that. You know, I do a fair amount of work with people of color, indigenous peoples, around the term decolonizing through a body sense, not even like in the legal systems and such or in our policies, but just physically and psychologically. Mm. And it's very much what you just said of how there's this concept that would be called let's say a post-colonial concept of, again, mind being supreme and just separated from the body, which is like this primitive wild thing that's not very intelligent, right?
Totally,
and the way that has gotten enacted historically on indigenous peoples has been, you know, very unfortunate. So I can see this work actually like reclaiming these old wise ways of living and kind of creating equality amongst people. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
I love that. Yeah, because I think Western science has it's made possible a lot of innovations, a lot of inventions, a lot of progress, but it's also left out so much and has created its own set of problems. So I think it's really time to reconsider the values that have driven that project and to be open to, you know, and interestingly, I am a science writer, as I said, and so everything that I'm writing about is based in very Western style science, you know, empirical inquiry. But it is very interesting to me that those methods are now being used to kind of finally validate and demonstrate the value of some older ways of living and knowing that have been around a lot longer than, you know, than the cognitive revolution and its ideas that human beings are just brains in vats.
Yeah, I love that. I love when you were saying that the mind is the whole body amongst other things. Mm-hmm. And so if we think of this extended mind and I'm visualizing, you know, we're extending beyond the brain and beyond the thinking realm above the head, and we're going into the whole body and we're fanning out into the space. And even what happens in the exchange of connection between two people, you know, mm-hmm. that integration of selves. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess what interests me about that is I think of the term muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And I think of like my work as a somatic therapist, which is understanding the trauma stored in the tissues and the fibers mm-hmm. of the being, not just the thought. So I guess I'm offering that up just to ask you how you experience thought from the body versus mm-hmm. just the brain.
Yeah. I like that trajectory you just sketched, because that was kind of the plan of the book, was to start with the body and move outward in these concentric circles, ever expanding circles, to our environment, to our relationships with other people. And you could keep going, you know, our society, our nation, all this stuff is ultimately related. But yeah, it does start with the body. And I think, you know, I always say that writers write what they need to learn. And that was definitely true for me. Like I'm a writer. I've been a freelance writer for more than 20 years. So I work in a very solitary way. And I am, you know, I'm always reading. I kind of live in my head, you know? So for me to, it's kind of ironic. I had to like read and research to persuade myself that actually the body is incredibly important. And that's the way I came to it. But I did write what I needed to learn, in the sense that I have become much less brain bound myself as a result of writing this book. And one of the most, that's been true in a couple of different ways. One is that I'm much more comfortable making gestures now. I realize how important gestures are. Physical movement has become much more a part of my life. But I think probably most importantly, I've become so much more aware of this internal flow of sensations that's with us all the time. You know, it's striking to me that in our culture, we have this notion that if you really want to get work done, if you really want to think hard, that means suppressing and pushing aside those internal sensations. You have to power through and get it done. And that means overriding what the body is telling you. And that seems to me now, I mean, I'm sure I once sort of adhered to that, but that seems to me now so wrong, in the sense that internal flow of sensations has so much to tell us. It carries so much information and so much wisdom that when we neglect it or actually actively kind of suppress it, we're really cutting ourselves off from this repository of wisdom that we all have.
You know, that segues right into something I wanted to speak to you about. So there's this trauma response known as fawning. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
But I have.
It's okay. So it's like the people-pleasing reflex, right?
Yeah.
And I think so much about the development of trauma responses. And one place my mind takes me is to the classroom, specifically, let's say preschool and elementary school. And I think of exactly what you just said, how there is this value placed upon one's ability to oppress their body, right? Yeah. You know, so like holding in their bladder, ignoring their hunger, waking up when they're not ready to wake up. And it's like, it's innocent because it's cultural and it's passed down. You know, I don't see things as like evil, but it's innocent. But these children, probably you and I included, growing in those kind of, I don't know, social constructs, not even a construct, because it's real, but these actual, what I want to say. I want to say environments and conditionings, perhaps, of just learning, oh, I get rewarded when I bypass and oppress myself. Tell me how that plays into all this.
And that's basically what learning to be at school means for most of us. I remember when my first son started preschool, I was both really proud that I'd gotten us both to this milestone of where he was in school and really sad because it meant a certain kind of regimentation was being imposed on this young child and his body, which before then had been so free. And like, so we were, as you know, when he was home with me, I was able to be so flexible and attentive and accommodating whatever he felt and whatever he needed to do. And I knew that school is all about, you know, even the most, you know, progressive, like, you know, touchy-feely kind of crunchy preschool is still really about regimenting the body and ordering it and controlling it in ways that, as I think you were indicating, are sort of in some ways necessary for society to operate and in other ways such a loss, you know, because we really lose touch with our bodies that way. And in order to fit in order to get approval, in order to feel good about ourselves, we kind of have to kill a part of ourselves, you know, we have to cut off that very intense connection with the body that I think children naturally have. And so I think there's ways, though, to reconnect and to regain that connection, even as adults. I feel that I've done that with this tuning into my interoception that we've been talking about. Interoception being that internal flow of sensations.
See, and so much you said there was important, because when you were saying we have to have some body control to fit in, it's like, fit into what? Fit into the standard. And, you know, 10 minutes ago or so, we were talking about how the standard once was body-based. And then, you know, over hundreds of years turned into more of like a mind supremacy of like thought and mind are higher forms than body and even nature, let's say.
Right.
You know, so it's interesting. I love your work because I love that your work is within the context of, I don't know, normal, like you said, imperial society. I love that it's in that context because that's where this work needs to come through. And with the language that makes sense to those of us with that kind of conditioning and that normalcy to show us, wait, there's value in this other, I would say, important kind of original form. And what if that became the standard? What would it look like to fit into that, right?
Yeah, because this is really, ultimately, it has to be about changing institutions, right? It can't just be about changing individual behavior, as powerful as that can be. And institutions, the way they operate in our world, they're responsive to this kind of scientific language and process and standards of evidence, you know, and all those things are important to me too, as a science writer and as a consumer of information. But I do like to trace those connections between what science is finding out now. It's so often the case that science sort of confirms things that other cultures or other times already knew. You know, in a previous book I wrote was on the science of prenatal influences, and it was covering this very exciting scientific field of fetal origins, finding that what the pregnant woman experiences, what she eats, the kind of stresses she feels when she's pregnant, all of those things affect the fetus in a way that may play out in the baby's and child's life. And what was so interesting to me over and over and over again when I was researching that book was that scientists were discovering things that other cultures and other times had known through close observation, through like traditions passed down through through generations. And so, you know, sometimes we need science to put its stamp on stuff that, you know, humanity has kind of already figured out.
Well, and no one can see you, but you know, you're doing air quotes around discovering. And so I just wanted to say that out loud.
Right.
Because it's really, I guess it would be more validating, right? It's like, it's through the research, through the data, it's validating something that's always been just known, not proven, but known. And I think that's powerful. I think it's important for those of us who really value data and research and the mind. Like, oh, okay, this says it's true. So now I can trust myself.
I know, isn't that funny? And that, like I was saying, that I've heard that again and again from readers, that they were like, thank you for giving me like the citations to back up like what I, you know, especially with teachers, for example, who are very experienced and have found over years of trial and error or years of working with kids, this is what works, you know, but they weren't necessarily finding that reflected back in them, back to them as legitimate, you know, until they saw it pulled together in this book.
So a question comes to mind. Is the subconscious the body?
Oh, that's really interesting. I think a lot of the operations of the subconscious take place in the body and are kind of expressed through the body. And, you know, I see that in a lot of the research that I write about in the extended mind. Some of it is that introspective awareness that carries non-conscious, the kind of non-conscious knowledge that we're collecting all the time as we go through life. There's so much information coming in that we can't process it all on a conscious level, but we are taking it in and we are storing it for later use. And the way we get access to that non-conscious information is through the body. You know, the body is letting us know you've encountered a situation like this before. The body is preparing us to deal with that situation by giving us these certain signals or preparing itself in various ways, like the heart starts beating faster or you start getting butterflies in your stomach. But then I also see that the subconscious operating or the unconscious operating in gestures, you know, like we're often not aware of what our hands are doing, but in fact, our hands are often, the movements of our hands are often a few steps ahead of what we're saying verbally and what we're aware of intellectually. So the body is like this conduit almost to the unconscious or the subconscious that that we are used to. Again, culturally speaking, we disparage or we dismiss, but it's often, as I've been saying, like a few steps ahead of the conscious mind.
I would agree. You know, I'm so happy you brought gesture in. I was going to circle back to that because you were saying that you've become more gestured, right?
And yeah.
I find what you said was so important, how the body is unconsciously, subconsciously, somatically taking in information that the conscious self is not aware of, like probably most of the time.
Right.
And so that I always call it the charge, like what you were calling interception, like that charge that moves through us. Mm-hmm. The body just knows what to do with that charge, you know, like I'm moving my hands and so it just knows to do that. And if we have something in us that's saying, stay still, that charge is essentially being compressed. And that's what becomes like stress and trauma from overwhelming events in my field of practice. So I'm curious how that relates to what you've discovered, specifically trusting the natural movement of the body so you can process and take in and move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. I mean, what it reminds me of is some research, finding that it actually takes a fair amount of mental bandwidth to suppress the natural urge to move. You know, we're meant to move, we evolved to move. And the demand that we stay still and sit still is actually really unnatural and requires a lot of effort to inhibit that natural urge to move. And so I think of it in terms of, you know, well, that's mental energy that you could be applying to your work or your learning or whatever. But that's very interesting to think about. Inhibiting or suppressing the body's natural reactions as a source of stress and perhaps trauma. You know, I think too about how the body can be a conduit between two people and how there's this, you know, I describe in the book how we don't have direct access to what other people are thinking and feeling. They're kind of like a black box, you know, but we always have access to our own bodies. And so there's this beautiful process called social interoception in which when we're talking to somebody, we're very subtly and unconsciously mimicking their facial expressions and their postures and their gestures. And then we read off our own bodies to get a sense of what that other person feels like. And otherwise we'd have no kind of access to them, but through our own bodies, we actually open this channel between two people. But if we're cut off from the feelings that we're having in our body, we don't have that access to what other people are feeling. So I think that's yet another reason that being open to what the body is telling us is so important.
I love that. You know, what I do this work with couples sometimes, like in private practice with couples therapy. And it's amazing, you know, when someone's saying something, let's say like one partner is speaking really tenderly or open-hearted to the other one, and the partner receiving this intimacy is like slowly crossing their arms and their shoulder is slowly moving away from, and it's what we would call unconscious, right? So there's this subconscious gesture that can handle the charge of intimacy. And because we're in a somatic context, I'm allowed to point that out, you know, notice how your shoulder is moving away from him or her, and you're covering your chest. And when they notice that, it's like the body is having its own response that the mind has no idea it's having.
Right. And you're bringing it into awareness, into everyone's awareness so that it can be dealt with. But if it just stayed, if no one pointed that out, if the person who was doing that, those gestures didn't have that pointed out to them, it would remain kind of inert, you know, and not usable.
That's exactly right. And that's why I'm using it as an example, because you're saying understanding the extended mind helps us essentially live better and like work better and learn better. And that's one way we even communicate better, when we notice, oh, I don't take in what someone says. Why is that? Oh, my body's doing this. Oh, what if I try this? You know, it's just these little moments of relating to that animal.
No, I absolutely see the extended mind as a way of thinking better. And as you say, living better, because it's embracing our full humanity and our full personhood in a way that we're so often encouraged not to do. We're encouraged to think of ourselves as I've been saying, as like information processors, you know, and that's such a limited way of thinking of humans who, as I've been saying, like the wellsprings of our intelligence and our, amazingness, you know, is the body, is like the way we relate to our physical world, the way we relate to other people. And like, we can't really be full humans unless we accommodate and recognize and acknowledge all those parts of us.
So what does that mean as adults in like a typical working American society? Like, what does that mean? What, you know, I'll be more specific. What does it look like if we were, if our culture ran around the extended mind, what would the ideal workplace look like?
That's nice to imagine. Yeah. Well, I think there's some opportunity. I mean, to make something like that happen. And I'm thinking about the fallout from the pandemic and the fact that it's made lots of people realize that the way we were working and living before was not working, you know, for a lot of us. And there's some potential new kinds of freedom, I think, that are opening up. I think for one thing, when people are able to work at home, they are able to make more accommodations for themselves and their bodies and their needs than at least the traditional office really made possible. And to the extent that managers and leaders are realizing that employees really were not satisfied with the status quo, like there's, again, I'm hopeful that there's some new opportunities to, for example, allow employees to attend to their bodies and their body's needs, in terms of, that those interoceptive sensations, being aware, checking in with oneself, maybe engaging in mindfulness meditation or a body scan, being able to be more physically active when you need to be, being able to go outside, being able to connect with people in more authentic and genuine ways. You know, there's so many ways that work could be made more humane than it is. And I think the pandemic has been an awful tragedy in a lot of ways, but I think it's also, it's shaken things up in a way that I think really makes room for change.
I couldn't agree more. As a therapist, it's been so enlightening to see how just in the work I do, individuals do so much better from their house. You know, having to get into the car and drive and like walk through a crowded street and into someone's office and then walk back out. It's like all these things that the body has to hold after processing traumatic events, or, you know, so to just be home and to be in that container, and for me to be home now and I close my office, it's like my nervous system's on a whole new level, right? Of ease. So
you realize how much armor you had to put on to go out and into the world every day like that. You know, you really had to armor up hold yourself very rigidly and sometimes keep that up all day. You know how exhausting that is. And when we feel comfortable in our homes and we belong in our homes and there, it's the space where we can relax and do our best work. I mean, I think that that really, you know, it's pushing back against the misconception, I would say, that if people are too relaxed or too happy, then they won't work hard, you know? Yes. And that's like a really pernicious kind of myth that people have to be in that kind of really stressed out state or else they won't work hard or they won't do their best. They won't perform at their best level. And I think that's just completely backwards, you know?
I couldn't agree more. A big part of my work is understanding adrenaline, right? Mm-hmm. And the body's relationship with adrenaline, because it's our fight-flight hormone. And so like when you're talking about having to be stressed or having to push through or having to be overwhelmed to get work done, we're essentially, again, we're just the way we're being ruled by mind supremacy, we're also being ruled by the adrenals. I always think of the statement from Dunkin' Donuts, like American runs on Dunkin'. And just like the word runs is in there. It's all about coffee and sugar. And it's like, we have to amp the body. Right. Why? Probably because we're doing things we don't even want to do half the time. But it so interests me that contemplation on why we think being adrenalized is the only way to finish something or understand something.
No, I totally agree. And when you think about how much mental bandwidth is taken up by, you know, I think for many people, being in an office is itself a stressful kind of experience. You feel like you're on display. You feel like you're being judged. You know, it's not necessarily a friendly or a welcoming or a kind of environment. And that takes up a lot of mental space just to deal with that, all those feelings that you have to kind of put out of your mind in order to do your work. And when all that's eliminated because you're in your own space and you feel comfortable and you feel at home, literally and figuratively, that just frees up so much, so many mental resources that you didn't have access to before.
I love that. I just so thank you for your work. I mean, I hope I can have you back in the future because there's so much I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
But you know, I want to do bite sizes for myself and the listeners. Where can we find your work? Do you have a website?
I do. I'm at www.anniemurphypaul.com. And I'm also really active on Twitter and I love to hear from readers on Twitter. So my handle is at Annie Murphy Paul.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for your work. It's so inspiring.
Oh, thanks. I've loved this conversation. Thank you so much, Lewis.
You take care. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice. What's your body doing right now? Sit with it. Let it speak to you. And let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen. For all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.